This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest is Clay Stafford, whose annual Writers' Festival, Killer Nashville, is back after having been cancelled last year. As you'll soon hear, Clay Stafford is a raconteur, a born storyteller with a wonderfully picaresque biography he's only too happy to share. He began by talking about his relationship with Arlie Heron, a professor and later the department head in the English department here at UTC.
I was in one of his classes, and one of the questions he decided he was going to go around the room and ask people, you know, because for Arlie, it was more than just literature. We're talking about life as well as related. And if you took his classes and you knew him, you knew that it was all applicable. The whole thing was applicable. So he decided he would go around the room and he would ask. And he always expressed a fondness for me, and we talked a lot privately. And he got around and he was asking everybody, what are you doing here? Why are you taking this course? Why are you here at this university? And he got to me. He said, Clay, you want to be a writer? And I said, yes. And he said, so why are you here? And I said, because I think that I need to have a degree so I have something to fall back on. And he said, well, let me tell you about this. He said, if you have something to fall back on, you'll always fall back on it. And I said, okay. And so then he went to the next person. I left his class, got all my books, put everything in the back of my car. I was on full scholarship at University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. I left the campus, and I never returned. About 10 years later, Arlie said, he saw me, and he's like, where the did you go? He said, you were in class one day, and then you just left. And I said, well, do you remember what you told me? And he said, no. So I told him what he told me, and he said, oh my gosh, you're the first person, I think, who ever listened to my advice. But I have to tell you that it was that mentality that sent me later to Los Angeles, living how I had to live, you know, nearly out of my car, wondering if I was going to get thrown out of my cheap one efficiency apartment as I was pursuing this particular dream. And in the back of my mind, I was always thinking about Arlie, if you ever, ever decide to take something that's going to be a fallback for you, then you'll never get where you want to go. And so that particular piece of advice, which came here from UTC, guided me and continues to guide me. It's a very difficult life if you really want to make a career of it. But if you leave yourself nothing to fall back on, then you just have to keep plowing forward. And the advice of Harrison Ford is that one of several things is going to happen. Number one, the main thing is everybody else is going to get disgruntled and they're going to just drop out. And in the end, you're going to be the last old guy standing there. And so you're going to do fine. And it worked well for Ford and it worked well for me. And I think all of it goes back to making that choice, because in my mind, I was thinking, you know, if I get a degree, as we sort of referenced before we started talking, if I get a degree, I can always fall back on it and teach while I'm trying to do this other stuff. Well, I left myself no option. I burnt the bridge. I put my stuff in my 1973 Chevy Nova with rust holes in the back seat. My friends who used to get in, I used to just laugh because it looked like a Fred Flintstone vehicle. The rust had eaten out the bottom of the car. I threw everything in there. I left and never came back. And all of it has to do with Arlie. And Arlie and I stayed in touch all the way up until his death, which was just a couple of years ago. So, you know, we all want approval, right? And so he was sort of like a dad type figure to me. And so
for many people, I think.
He was. He had that kind of personality. And so to have that really made me feel like, okay, he approved. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
When was that that Arlie said that to you?
Probably around 1982.
And you were a student age?
I was student age. I'm doing undergraduate. And I mean,
So you had a full scholarship?
I did. I was a chancellor scholar, a valedictorian scholar.
You're in your early 20s?
Yes.
Were you living at home?
Yeah, actually, I grew up in Eastridge, but all of my relatives were in Appison. So we had that Appalachian mentality. And very interesting thing, my mother, as I said before, my background is English, Irish, Scottish. And so part of my lineage, last name, of course, is Scots. And there's just like this thing of little strip of, you see the, right in the light, you will see this band of red hair still on my head, which is like, you know, the last little remnant of my Scottish association. But I can't remember. I'm sorry. I just lost my train of thought.
No worries. So I've got this straight. You're on full scholarship. You're at the university, valedictory scholar. And you come home one day and say to your mum and dad, "I'm leaving school and I'm going to Los Angeles."
Yes.
And their reaction was
complete. A lot of these stories they don't know because I'm going to tell them later on when they get older because I don't want them repeating history. And I guess for those listening, my children are sitting in here in the studio with us. So I had that whole Appalachian heritage background that was going on, and I started out as a kid actor. When I was 10, I was touring. When I was 12, I was in New York City.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. So I've been in this business a long, long time. There may or may not be. Do you remember Pat Paulson?
Yeah.
Okay. He did a show called called Laugh In. It was a wonderful experience for me, and I was young enough that it really didn't make an impression. But I'd watch him on Laugh In, and then there's a picture I think on my website somewhere of me sitting with him in New York City. We had gone to see The Fantastics, a musical. I later played El Gallo on tour for that particular show, so many years later. But yeah, I was in New York when I was 12. I was in Los Angeles when I was 14, hitting the modeling agencies.
By yourself?
By myself. My parents were completely clueless. And of course, it was a different time.
A little different, but not a lot different. This was in the 70s?
This was in the 70s, yes.
Oh, you're in Los Angeles by yourself?
Yes.
How did you negotiate that?
Well, I had a cousin who was in San Clemente, and he was much older than I, and he was in the film business as well, but he was in from the engineering side. He goes back, like Candace Bergen babysat his daughter. So he goes back a long way to, as a matter of fact, we were just in upstate Washington where my cousin lives, and I told her, I said, "Do you remember Candace Bergen babysitting you?" And she said, "No, my dad never told me that story." And I said, "Yeah, he used to babysit and then go down to the Brown Derby." I don't know if you're familiar with the old Brown Derby. But yeah, I used to go out there. And so when I was 14, I was out there, and I would be on the Santa Monica Pier unsupervised with, who was the girl, that the lady that gave John Belushi the overdose? Kathy Smith? Maybe. Mm-hmm. And then Ronald Reagan's dentist. And we would sit out there, and I was 14, and play darts on the Santa Monica Pier as we were there. But I had my cousin, he had been with the studio business for a long time. So one day he went over to Jack Warner's place over at Warner Brothers. And Jack told my cousin, he said, "You know, what I need, we're having a real problem with recording because we've got the camera set up and we've got the cables for the sound for the actors, but these cameras are so loud, we need to be able to move these things back to get them away so it's not picking up the sound because we're having to redub an awful lot of what we're doing." And so Floyd, my cousin, he said, "Okay, I can put together a team of engineers." So they started developing something, and they developed the connectors. They connected sound cables together, and from that, the jazz singer came with Al Jolson.
How old was your cousin?
Very old. I mean, his daughter was already, when I was 14, his daughter was already grown and gone and had children and stuff, so I would say he was probably in his 60s or 70s.
Well, you started talking about Jack Warner, and I had no idea how old Jack Warner was, but I don't think he lived into the 70s.
No.
That's really interesting.
So I had a cousin who had been in the film business. So the funny thing is, we went out when I was 14, and he was going to introduce me to everybody, and then he started, and it was heartbreaking because he started started looking around, everybody who knew was dead. And so it was like, okay, well, I can't introduce you to that. But let me tell you what happened, because I was in by when I
well,
when
this
I,
guy must have been a legend. He was one of the seminal figures in filmmaking.
Yes, except from the engineering side. Yeah, so there's no stardom
but he
in
made
that.
It possible
but
to make
he
the
made
thing.
It possible. He created the connectors that are still being used today. I'm sure they're upgraded much from what they used to be. But
you would hope.
But the whole idea was to be able to get a connector that didn't go, you know, in cause crackling in between the two. And yeah, Floyd was over the team that created that, and he did a lot of innovations for the film industry through the company that he was working on. We
so
did
you
this
say
one
you,
thing.
Your parents were clueless, but they weren't really, because you had family over there. When you went to Los Angeles at 14, you had somewhere to go.
I had somebody to go to, and when I went to New York at 12, I had Brant Edwards, who was a star on Broadway. They had just opened A Chorus Line.
Ah, really?
Yes.
So this was 76, 77, somewhere there?
Yeah, and so I went to New York, and I slept for a summer underneath a grand piano, a baby grand piano, because there was no bed. You know, New York apartments are not for actors on Broadway. New York apartments are like, you know, the size of the studio, just a little bit bigger. And so he had a baby grand piano, and I had a bed underneath the piano that he let me crash on. But it was an interesting, absolutely interesting time. I studied with Martha Graham. I studied with Frank Luigi Jazz Dance, and Frank Prietri, who did a lot of choreography. I think he was involved with All That Jazz and A Chorus Line and a bunch of other stuff. So my youth was spent doing those activities. And here's the interest. I was traveling to all of these places, as you alluded to, at a very young age. And when I went to Los Angeles, I rode a bus 3 days and three nights by myself, because that's all we could afford, rather than an airplane flight. So all of this to say that when I came back home, there was nothing in my young mind. I was clueless. I didn't know that I was supposed to be intimidated. I didn't know that I was supposed to be enthralled. All I knew was these were very nice people, and then they thought this little kid with a Southern accent, you know, he's funny. And so they were always lending a hand to me. And so when I would come back home, I had relatives with no running water, no electricity, and then I would be in Manhattan with those people and in Los Angeles with those people. And never in my mind did I ever think that it was that there was any difference between the two. But anyway, I was going to...
So you were, just so we can get the timeline straight, so you were a performer when you were a teenager. How long were you a performer?
Yeah, until... Well, I don't know. It depends on radio. Ours is performers, aren't they? So are we still doing this here, Richard?
But when was that your main avocation?
You know, I woke up when I was around 29 years old. I'd been working full-time as an actor, and I woke up one morning and looked at my dog, and I said, you know, this is starting to feel like a job.
Oh, I can only imagine. Were you in Los Angeles at that
point? Yeah, I was living in Beverly Hills at the time, on Bedford Drive.
Sounds like a nice address.
It was. It was a very nice address. It was right down the street from the corner where Richard Gere, Pretty Woman, you know, where he goes into the store and he says, you know, I need some sucking up.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
that was up the block up from where I was living. So
that's a pricey address, isn't it?
It was a price. If we want to go there, yes. I was doing very well.
Evidently. but you were tired of...
But I was just...
Doing.
It felt like it was more of a job.
This is Scenic Roots Talking Writing. Our guest, Clay Stafford, grew up in Chattanooga. In his life, he has been, among other things, a writer, an actor, and a producer. When he was 16, he formed a production company in Chattanooga and began making commercials for local businesses. You made this commercial for the bank.
Yeah,
when you were 16.
I was 16, yeah. So, you said I was an actor, yeah. But I was also a producer, director, writer from a very early age.
What was the first thing you wrote?
First thing I wrote, I actually, when I was in fourth grade, I went to Molly Miles, who is still alive, and maybe hopefully she's listening, Molly Miles. She was the librarian at Spring Creek Elementary School, where I went to school, and she thought that I had some talent. And she asked me what I wanted. And I said, I'd love to have a newspaper, because I think it was like Citizen Kane or something I had watched as a kid. And I was deciding that I want to have a newspaper. And so she said, well, let me have a newspaper. So the very first thing I wrote was a newspaper, and I would write stories for the newspaper, sell them at school. And eventually it became such a big seller that it was using all of the stacks of the newspaper. And Mrs. Running, who was the principal, was like, what is the budget? It's going up. All this paper is being spent. And it's because Clay is working on a mimeograph. Remember the mimeograph mm-hmm. paper? And so we would put it on the roller. And I love that smell. Probably it's like, you know, bad for you smelling gasoline. But I just love the smell of that mimeograph paper going on. So I started writing early, and then I started selling.
What'd you write about?
I found a really funny one in the attic probably about a year ago, where I did an essay on Richard Nixon. And which brings up, you know, you said, what are you working on now? Well, I'm doing a political thriller. So I guess, you know, it's ingrained.
Everything comes full circle,
as the 10-year-old all the way to now.
A 10-year-old writing a newspaper is a dangerous creature, because you don't know boundaries at that age. You know?
Correct. And it made it very, very funny. And then let me tell you, here's the marketing side, because I do a lot of marketing stuff as well. You see my resume, you have to do a lot of marketing stuff as well. So what I realized is that people didn't necessarily, now this is a precursor for what news has become, right? But I saw it at age 10. They want to know who likes who. So you
were right there to cause trouble.
Yeah,
from the
I was. So I would know that John had a crush on Sally, and
neither one wanted that.
John wanted it, everybody to know, and so a whole column was just devoted to, yeah, John and Sally, you know, were their fourth graders. John and Sally are dating again. And so anyway,
all right. So we've got the seeds of this.
Are you trying to get back on
no,
track?
No, I'm
somewhere?
Not trying to do anything anymore. I've given up. But. You're the president of a publishing company, so that's your writing.
Yes,
part. So then you also
you're in control here, Richard.
barely. You also have a writers' conference.
Yes.
So those are sort of related, and then you are the CEO of an independent film, television, stage, et cetera, American Blackguard.
Yes.
So that sort of goes back to. Well, it all kind of comes from the same place. I suppose,
it's storytelling. It's like what it all comes down to. It's storytelling,
and you're.
And let's talk about Killer Nashville.
Which would you prefer to be in front or behind the camera?
I love a good story. It doesn't really matter.
Rather make it as a film than as a book?
You know, it's two completely different animals. I can get into a character much better in a book than I can in a film, because I'm limited to sound and picture. Mm-hmm. And I do not have access to inner thoughts. So the political thriller I'm writing right now is, I'm writing the book, but I've also, with my agent, I'm writing the screenplay as well, because I do write screenplays and have written screenplays and have developed series like for Sony Pictures and others in the past.
How do you write a screenplay and a novel simultaneously?
I guess years of experience, that the best way to tell this particular scene is this way, but in the back of my mind, I know when I come back to it to write the screenplay for it, I know that it's going to have to be told a different way.
So you write the novel first and then adapt it to a screenplay?
It depends. It depends. But on this particular one, yes, I'm writing the novel
confused,
first.
Clay?
I stay. You've done this interview with me. Obviously, I stay confused. My wife refers to me as an absent-minded professor. I've always got these characters going on in my head, and I've got planning on how that I'm supposed to write. And it's just a job. It just becomes part of the job.
How much of your time do you spend doing that?
Doing what?
Professor? The writing.
All the time. So I have a minimum of 4 hours a day that's devoted to writing.
Do you?
Yes.
Do you have that discipline where you get up?
Yes, I do have that. Yeah, I do. And you have to have that discipline.
Well, some say you do. Some say, you know.
I've never met the muse, but I do know I show up. And as long as I can keep the crowd alert, I'm happy. It's, you know, that old Zig Ziglar thing about the one-eyed discus thrower. It's not very good, but it keeps the crowd alert. That's how I kind of feel, right?
So this is how you start your day in front of a blank screen.
Yes. Morning is my best time.
You write
for
on
writing.
The computer?
Yes. I have note cards that I carry with me. When an idea hits, I jot it down. I have my, I brought this in here. You think I'm bringing it in here to take notes, but I'm also bringing it in here if I get an idea for something, I will jot it down as we're talking, and it has nothing to do with what we're talking about right here. So it becomes a compulsion. It's a 24/7 thing. You know, this pad is by the bed at night. You wake up at night and do it.
The notion that you're ADD, I think it's just the opposite. You're very focused. You couldn't,
yeah, I am
you couldn't
focused.
Be otherwise.
Yes, I am focused.
And accomplish all you're accomplishing.
Yes. Yeah.
Like Killer Nashville, for instance. How long does that take you to organize that?
Well, the first time I came home, this is how my ideas usually work. You know what? We need a writing conference because the internet is opening up. This is 2006. The internet is opening up. I've done a lot of stuff with academic in the past, and I've done, you know, I designed a film curriculum, Miami-Dade. I designed the film curriculum for the film people in Orlando, a two-year program to create technicians for Orlando. So I've been in education for a while. I started a small local book festival for the people, and I wanted to do, internet opened up, and I thought, wow, there's the world. Mm-hmm. Now, you're talking to someone who launched films at Universal, right? So we're talking about the release of Mask. I did publicity on Mask. I did publicity on Back to the Future, Robert Zemeckis' film. And your thinking at that point is global, right? Mm-hmm. We're opening in theaters worldwide.
So this was in the 80s.
This was in the 80s.
This is old school Hollywood, right?
It's like old school Hollywood, yes. It was a fabulous time. The wonderful thing, you know, Steven Spielberg, he worked his way onto the Universal lot and ended up finding a private office. So I thought, you know, I can do that. If he and Lucas can get by doing this, I can do that. So I ended up going the same particular route because I thought it seemed like a, you know, the best thing to do if you find somebody that's, you know, you want to do something, find somebody who's done what you want to do and then you imitate them, right?
What becoming I'm getting a, is in Hollywood, is you are who you say you are.
Yeah. So becoming a squatter in an office in at Universal is already been done and obviously did very well for the Spielberg guy. So I think I should do it as well.
Well, you already had a history of that. You had 20 years of from the time you were a teenager presenting yourself as being something.
Exactly.
You're not quite what you are.
Exactly. So I walk in and security, I go over to Amblin. I just walk into Amblin just like I work there. And I was going to go see Steven and talk to him about working with him. And so the security came descending upon me and I made it as far as the little lunchroom area. But the security came and they said, who are you? And I said, well, I'm Clay Stafford and I'm here. I'm going to work in Hollywood. And they said, well, this is private property and, you know, you're going to be arrested and put in jail for trespassing for coming here. And I said, that's fine. But I will work for Mr. Spielberg. So I left, and lo and behold, I got to work with him on Jurassic Park. I got to work with him on Amazing Stories.
How did you do that?
Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
How did you do that?
It's all serendipitous. It really is. I call it bumbling. And so in one of my treks over at Universal, someone asked, would you take the golf cart over and pick up this guy in the Black Towers and take him? Liz Ramirez was the one who asked me. Liz Ramirez asked me if I would go pick up this guy and take him back to the back. So I said, yeah, sure. So I go and I pick him up. Well, I didn't really know for sure who he was. It was Lou Wasserman, the last of the moguls.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's in a golf cart with me, and I'm driving, and I really don't know who he is. So
did you know where you were supposed to be taking him?
Yeah, we went over to see Robert Redford.
Yeah, but how did you know that? Did you know the layout of the lot?
Oh, yeah, I knew the layout of the lot. I used to go hang out with the editors at Universal. I wasn't supposed to be in there, but I would go hang out, and they were like, okay, well, this kid really wants to learn something. So they would sit there, and while they were editing back then, it was still editing on film. And so, you know, reel one, dialogue, reel two, and, you know, putting it all together on this big flatbed. Mm. And so I learned how to edit 35mm film from these old editors who were
that
working.
That must have been amazing to watch.
Yeah, sitting there working on Jaws, and you're sitting there watching how they're putting this together. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Because the whole experience is so virtual.
Yeah.
You know, they have to have this meta vision while at the same time they're dealing with these micro mm-hmm. things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a specific talent, isn't it?
Yes.
To be able to do something.
Absolutely.
Like that.
Editors can save or destroy.
Yeah.
They are wonderful, except for Hitchcock, who only shot what he needed because he knew the editors and the studio could control it. So he only shot what he wanted. And that was his trick to say, this is my vision. Oh, I'm sorry, you've only got one take. There's no way you could change it. So anyway.
Well, he also, he storyboarded his stuff so tightly, didn't
yes,
he?
Yes, yes. And that's where Spielberg got his storyboarding. And then I picked it up from Spielberg. And so I'm a big storyboarder. Oh, and even in my writing, even in writing novels, it comes down to storyboarding for me. It's basically the whole storyboarding idea because I can see those graphic novel pictures in my head. And I've even done the thing Steven Spielberg had said, you know, wrap the entire room in storyboard. And I have done that on, like, you know, regular typing paper, just put it up and poke pin into the walls.
You're something of a Renaissance man. You're a publisher. And you also organize a book festival.
Mm-hmm.
The book festival is kind of an outgrowth of your work as an educator, isn't it? Because there's definitely an educational component to that.
It is, and it's a way of giving back. And that's what it all comes down to. And interestingly enough, I've done this since 2006. I've never taken a dime, not one dime, from my efforts. It's my charity. Because there is no way this Appalachian kid should be able to end up in Hollywood working with some of the biggest names, in New York working with some of the biggest names, and then have a conference working with some of the biggest names.
I think it can be summarized as chutzpah.
Could be. I had these mentors who always helped me all the way through. So when it came to the point that I saw, oh, this internet is really an interesting thing. This is a wonderful way to help people everywhere. Because we can reach people everywhere. So we ended up creating a conference, an international writers conference. And within the first year after that, we had our first Canadian. And now we have people coming from Japan, Korea, Australia, Scotland, all over Italy, all over the world, who come to Killer Nashville every year.
So tell me about the conference. How long does it last?
It lasts Thursday through Sunday. There's five concurrent tracks. We have things for every writer. If you've got an idea and you have no clue what you want to do, there's a certain track for you. If you have a manuscript ready to go, there's a certain track for you. If you want to learn more about incorporating mystery, thriller, suspense into your stories, no matter what particular genre you're writing, there's another one. There's a publicity and marketing thing that goes through. We've had New York Times bestsellers who come to the conference just to take the publicity and marketing, because we stay on top of what is the newest platform in order to market yourself. And so, you know, you may be at this level and you're a New York Times bestseller, but you really want to go on this next level. And so in order to do that, you come and learn those tools. And so we've got people, and then we've got a forensic track. And we have our CSI junkies who just show up. We have a crime scene where we have a mock crime scene where there's a dead body. We learn how to position that, because with the first one of the first years we did it in a conference room, and some of the hotel guests walked by and saw it, called 911, and then we had like a big fiasco of all these units showing up. But anyway, it's at the Embassy Suites in Cool Springs in Franklin, outside of Nashville. You're just like 20 minutes from downtown Nashville.
It's open to everybody?
It's open to everybody. And so people come in there and meet people, and it becomes lifelong mentoring. And you can see the theme coming back, right?
So let me amend what I said. Chutzpah, definitely, but also clearly astonishing people skills. So you have taken what you did in this kind of ad hoc way, and to some degree you formalized it.
Yes.
In the form of a festival.
Yes.
Do people have to register for this festival?
They do, and they can register online. They can just go to www.killernashville.com.
And then that's open now.
And it's open now, mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Killer Nashville Festival is set for Thursday, August 19th through Saturday, August 22nd. Details are on the website, newpages.com. This is Scenic Roots, talking writing on listener-supported public radio in Chattanooga.